Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce Jan Ellison, the author of A Small Indiscretion, who has a really great story about how she came to write the novel and how the novel, you know, in a way fulfilled her dreams as a writer and how it took so long. Anybody who's interested in writing and has hope, here's another reason to keep that hope. Jan Ellison.
Thank you. Thank you, George. That is such an interesting concept about good and evil and how relative it is. I have learned about this firsthand by doing book clubs with my book. You know, a title like A Small Indiscretion is going to, depending on where you stand on the temperature, the good-evil temperature continuum, prejudice you in one direction or another. And I have sat in book clubs where people have debated the ethics or the question of where does the narrator of this book, Annie Black, fall on that continuum of good to evil. And it has become very clear to me that people bring their own experience and their own place between that hot and cold to the reading of any piece of literature, or maybe to the reading of any, you know, moral judgment like that. So it's been fascinating. One of the things that has been fascinating recently is that I went to an all-girl Catholic high school in L.A., and it's run by Dominican sisters. And a year ago, the head of the school asked me to, who has read the book, A Small Indiscretion, actually came to my reading in Pasadena, asked me to address the commencement. It's this coming Sunday, and of course, this was months ago, and I said yes. And then a month ago, she said, are we still on? And it occurred to me that I have to give a speech to 1,000 people at this all-girl Catholic high school. And my views have shifted somewhat since the time that I was 17, graduating from that all-girl Catholic high school, whose motto is that they are preparing women for a life of faith, integrity, and truth. And I thought, okay, how can I take those words and concepts and, you know, adjust them to fit my current belief system? How can I say something true? And at the same time, I was honored that the sisters were broad thinking enough to take a book like A Small Indiscretion, which addresses a lot of issues in all their complexity, I hope, and, you know, still want me to give this speech. Hopefully they will not regret it. So I thought to myself, well, what do I actually have to say to these young women who are 17 and 18? I sat in those chairs 33 years ago, actually gave the valedictorian address then, 33 years ago, shocking. And I tried to find that speech so that I could understand what I knew then versus what I wish I had known. I couldn't find the speech. So I have to just try to recreate it. And I think that the one thing that I know for sure is that I was way more confident than I ought to have been when I stood on that stage when I was 17. And that if there is one thing I have learned, it's that life is not going to be what you expect it to be. And you're not going to believe in yourself the way you perhaps do on this day. And that you can't sit around and wait until you do. You have to just keep going anyway. And then I guess the other thing I wanted to share with them is that the interruption of our best laid plans is sometimes what clears the way for our destinies. And that was certainly true for me in the long and winding road to finally realizing that what I wanted to do was write, and then writing the book and finally publishing it. So I'll just tell you that story. When I graduated from high school, I had been studying French, and then I went off to college, and I kept studying French for 2 more years. Sophomore year, I decided, well, it had always been my plan to spend my junior year abroad in Paris, living with the French family, speaking nothing but French, studying at the Sorbonne, sitting in cafes. That was basically my idea. So I filled out my application in flawless French. I was very confident in my French abilities at the time. And then I showed up for the interview with the French department, which was in a large conference room with this huge oval table and people sitting all around the table shooting questions at me in French, and I just panicked and forgot how to speak French, and I was not invited to the Stanford in Paris program, which was devastating, given that this had always been my plan. But I was determined, so I saved some money over the summer, and I went to Paris anyway. I just decided I'll take a quarter off, and I'll go anyway. So I found an apartment. I was with another friend who was in a similar situation. We rented this apartment from these two college boys who actually they were entrepreneurial, and their entrepreneurial plan was that they were going to rent out one of the apartments that their parents were paying for, move in together, and therefore raise some funds entrepreneurially. Of course, they hadn't told their parents about this plan, and so we weren't allowed to answer the phone during the 3 months that we lived there, lest it was the parents calling, wondering why these young American girls were living in the apartment that they were paying for. And during that time, I took a few French classes at L'Alliance Française, which was all the way across town, so I didn't make it there all that often, and you know, drank a lot of red wine, and traveled around on weekends and took notes. And, I mean, looking back on it, it was the taking notes that really was the thing that most interested me during that time. And I wasn't taking notes in French. I was taking notes in English. And I was reading novels, and they weren't in French. They were in English. So I think it was sort of a way of finding out that maybe, you know, maybe French language wasn't really where my heart was. I was supposed to be home for Christmas, and instead I decided, well, I'll go somewhere where they speak English. That'll be easy to get a job. So I decided to head off to London, take the whole year off. And I think I had about $50 left at that time, and yet my mother let me head off to London. I checked into a youth hostel. It was about 2 weeks after I arrived in London, I turned 20, and I called her from one of those iconic red phone booths, and I put coins in long enough for her to wish me a happy birthday. And then I stepped outside, and I have this distinct memory of the feeling I had standing on the sidewalk in London, knowing that nobody in my life could find me. And, you know, I don't think my mother even knew how to make an international phone call at that time, and if she had known, she wouldn't have been able to afford it anyway. I was staying in a youth hostel. This is before cell phones, before internet. And it was a wonderful moment for me. I had this incredible feeling of freedom. And I just thought, well, I can do whatever I want now, and it won't matter. And that was true for me. In the novel, it turns out not to be true for me so far, anyway. In the novel, the main character, Annie Black, goes on a similar journey. And it turns out that some of the things she's done during that time come back and have tremendous impact on her future. And that's kind of how the novel plot turns. Anyway, I think that it's an important moment in the sense that it's a moment that's been lost to history. You know, I have four kids. The eldest is 19, 17, 14, and 11. And it gives me great peace to know that they will never be free of me in the way that I was free of my family then. I'll always be able to find them. But it's also kind of bittersweet because I think that those months living by myself, being lonely, walking the streets of the city on weekends by myself, really was what turned me into a writer much, much later. I didn't think I wanted to be a writer, but I was writing a lot. I was taking notes. I was writing the beginnings of bad stories, and I was writing bad poetry, and I was describing, you know, situations I saw and settings, and I was writing down bits of pieces of dialogue that I heard. And if I had not been completely on my own, I would not have had that time to digest those experiences in language. I mean, if you think about my kids' generation, I had the impulse to share my experience, but I let it sit for 20 years before I did that. They let it sit for less than 20 seconds with Snapchat. You know, they experience something, and as they're experiencing it, they are thinking about sharing it, and it's instantaneous. And I think that's a great loss. And I hope that reading books, which is still one of the very few things that you do by yourself without doing anything else. That's very difficult to multitask, unless you're listening to a book on tape and driving at the same time. But it's a solitary experience of a deep emotional situation, a story that you absorb by yourself. So when people say, well, what is your solution to this dilemma that we find our children in, I hope that it's reading books. Anyway, I worked in London for 6 months. I came home and went back to college. And you would think by then that I would have had the sense that maybe my calling had something to do with language, but I didn't. I actually, over the weekend at our community pool, I ran into a guy, and he came rushing up to me, and he said, I knew you from Stanford. I was your computer science TA. And I said, you were? Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. Because I came back from overseas, and I decided the thing to do would be to get serious and take computer science and take calculus and do all the things that other people had been doing to lay the foundation for a career of some kind. I don't know why I thought that, but that's, I guess, because I'd worked in an office. So I signed up for calculus and this accelerated computer science course called CS106X, which was the two introductory courses in one quarter. To frame this, I was a history major. I have only gotten one C in my entire academic career. It was in accounting. I only dropped one class, calculus, that's that quarter. And so I'm chatting with this guy at our pool, and he says, yeah, it was, we all couldn't figure out why you were there. It was kind of a committee effort to get you through that class. And so I was a little embarrassed knowing that I was such a problem child. I did manage to finish that class. I dropped the calculus class. I went back to history. I took some creative writing classes, kind of got my act together. And then, again, I pushed that away and lined up a job when I graduated, as one does, with an investment bank. Again, you know, the only C I ever got, financial accounting, but somehow I managed to get Morgan Stanley to hire me as a financial analyst, and I persuaded myself that this was the appropriate career step. And I cashed the signing bonus. The signing bonus may have had something to do with that decision, and I bought some beautiful suits at Macy's on sale, and I found a place to live in Manhattan, and then I went to Hawaii on this last hurrah week's vacation with my two roommates, who had very cleverly avoided anything as unoriginal as gainful employment and decided to go back to Hawaii and get jobs as cocktail waitresses and then travel around the world. That's what they were doing. And I had this plan to become an investment banker of all things. So I was faced with this existential dilemma. Should I take the trip with them or should I become an investment banker? So I did what one does when faced with a dilemma, existential or otherwise. I called my mother. And my mother said, oh, honey, take the trip. And she had been the breadwinner. She had made all the sacrifices. I expected her to say, you know, buckle down, get a job. But she didn't. And she said, and I will pay your student loans while you're gone. And so I moved back to Hawaii and couldn't get a job as a cocktail waitress, actually, because you had to have experience, but I got a job as a banquet waitress at the Hyatt Hotel, and there was one bookstore in town. I was living in Maui. It was actually up a little ways up the road, and I would ride my bike up there, and I started buying paperbacks, and I started reading novels like crazy. Like anything written in the last 5 years, any literary novel, I read it. And I was taking notes again. I still didn't have this sense of myself as wanting to be a writer or anything, but I was reading and writing all the time. And I lived in Hawaii, and then I lived in Australia for a year working, and then I traveled around Southeast Asia by myself, backpacked in the Himalayas, and took trains all over India, and then went to Hong Kong thinking I'll get a job in Hong Kong. But that proved to be difficult, so I never did manage to get a job in Hong Kong. Came home. Again, broke and thinking the last thing I want to be is a writer because that's really lonely and you can't make any money. So I joined this financial software startup, and this was in the years before the derivatives trading desks of major commercial and investment banks brought down the financial system, but we were building risk management and trading systems for derivatives. And you're asking yourself, how did she, with her C in financial accounting, figure out this derivatives trading software? I didn't. I never did. I faked it for 5 years running marketing for this company, and I thought that I could tie that into this commencement address by saying that sometimes you have to fake it. Sometimes you have to fake it to put, you know, dinner on the table or pay your mortgage or your rent, but in the long run, faking it is going to starve your soul. And I finally figured that out once I had my first kid, and I just said, you know, I'm faking it. I'm standing up here talking about derivatives trading systems. Not only do I not believe in this as a viable thing to do with your life, I don't even understand it. So I quit and stayed home to take care of my kids. There are four of them now. There were two of them then. And signed up for my first writing class when I was 33. And it was almost the day that I quit the job. I think I had been getting the Stanford Continuing Studies catalogs for years, and I had been eyeing those creative writing courses, and I finally could do it. And so I just took one class a week for many years. The first class I took was called On Keeping a Notebook, which was perfect because I had a lot of experience keeping a notebook. I had no experience actually writing any stories. I certainly had no experience attacking a novel, but I had been keeping notes for all these years. And that class was taught by Alice LaPlante, who's a local writer who wrote a beautiful book called Turn of Mind a few years ago. I think it won your prize, the California Book Award. Anyway, she was a wonderful mentor. She was teaching at San Francisco State MFA program. She said, you know, you should try to do that. So I managed to write a short story. And it was not easy to, people think, oh, you sign up for a short story class and you write a short story. That is not easy. At least it was not easy for me. It's much easier to start with small pieces, the building blocks of writing, you know, writing images, writing vignettes, to get the foundation down and then allow those to, you know, inform your writing until such time as a whole story kind of emerges. It's ironic because it was very hard for me to finish my first short story, and in the last 10 years, every time I've tried to write a short story, it's turned into a novel manuscript, and so I'm not doing that anymore. I'm not starting short stories and then accidentally ending up writing novels or half novels. So I finally finished a couple short stories. One of them was sort of done enough. I thought I should start sending it out. I had won the prize, the short story prize at San Francisco State that year. So somebody gave me an excellent piece of advice, which I'm going to pass on to any of you who are aspiring writers, and that is your job at the time when you finally decide it's time to start sending my work out, and I would have by waiting for as long as possible to do that, because you've only got one shot at each of these places that you want this story to get published. So you better make sure that it's ready. And it won't be anyway, but wait a while anyway. So the piece of advice was, your job is not to get published. Your job is to collect 100 rejection letters. Right? This is like an achievable goal. We can all achieve this goal, every single one of us in this room. So I set out to collect 100 rejection letters, and I am goal-oriented, and I did this obsessive analysis of the Best American Short Stories and the Pushcart Prize and the O. Henry Prize and ranked all the journals and sent my story off to The New Yorker and The Atlantic Monthly, as one does. And I never did get a response from The New Yorker, but I got a note back from C. Michael Curtis at The Atlantic Monthly on that first short story that I submitted. I've since learned that lots of people have notes from C. Michael Curtis. I think he sits there all day dictating little tiny notes to his assistant, who then sends them out to unsuspecting writers. This was probably 10 years ago now. The note read, "You write with feeling, but your story is awfully ruminative, comma, and internalized. We're not drawn to it, I'm sorry to say. Not that I committed it to memory or anything, but it really stuck in my craw, this ruminative, comma, and internalized." First of all, why is there a comma there? It doesn't belong in the sentence. But I went back to the story and I said, okay, what's ruminative here and what's internalized? And I didn't take out a lot because I write fiction that is ruminative and internalized. Let's, you know, there is stuff happening. This is a plot-driven novel, but it wasn't when I started out. It's not my first impulse. The plot kind of emerges much later. And I did that for all four stories that I was sending out. I'd send it out to 10 places. I'd get all the rejection letters, and this is over a period of probably 2 years. And then I'd rewrite the story. And I have been asked, how did you have the energy or the belief? How did you believe in yourself enough to go back and revise? And the answer is, I certainly did not believe in myself. And I don't think it's about belief. And I think if you wait till you believe in your abilities as a writer, you'll be waiting for a long time. But what I did have was a compulsion to make the story better. And that, I felt, came out not of a wish to publish, but it was like the work itself was saying to me, I can be better, and you're the only one who can make me better, so please make me better. And I felt I owed it to my work to dive back in and every time be brutal about slashing and cutting and being willing to shift anything at any time. And that is something that did become a habit over many years, so that by the time it came time to edit the novel, I was used to shredding it and not getting too attached. You know, the famous line is, be ready to kill your darlings, and you do have to do that. So I'm sending out these stories. I probably was very close to 100 rejections. And then the New England Review published my first short story, The Company of Men, and I'll tell you a funny bit about that. Of course, when you're writing, you don't really think anybody's ever going to read your work, so that gives you a certain freedom to write whatever you want. And then when you finally publish that first short story, and because it was my first published work, I ordered a whole box of New England reviews of that issue, and it arrived on my doorstep, and I opened the box really excited, and I picked it up, and I realized my mother-in-law is going to read this. And the 10 years of effort I have spent persuading her that I belong in her traditional Midwestern Catholic family are going to have been wasted. But she read it, and she got over it. And then 6 months later, I got another call from the editor at New England Review telling me that the story had won an O. Henry Prize, which is one of the prize collections every year. They publish the 20 best stories of the year, which, by the way, I wrote a blog post recently about this best of mania. I wrote it after my novel had finally made a best of list, because you think about this, and this is what I wrote in the blog. Picking a best novel of the year or a best short story or the, you know, however many best of, is so ridiculous in a way. It would be like me saying, oh, of my four children, that's the best one. I mean, that would be absurd, right? Each of those children has given me immeasurable joy, and that is true of every book that I, really, of every book that I finished, because I start a lot of books, but I don't finish them. And so I think it would be nice if we could get away from this best of idea and embrace the idea that, you know, art, many different kinds of art and pieces of art and literary works give us meaning and joy, and we don't necessarily have to rank them. But anyway, it was awesome. I got in this best of thing. I was really psyched. It was my big lucky break, I would say. And I thought, oh, now, you know, it'll be super easy to publish the rest of these stories. It wasn't. That first story was rejected by 27 journals. The fourth one that I published and the last one that I've ever written was rejected at least 50 times. And the clever trick was that I kept renaming it every time I would totally revise it. I would rename the story. It kept getting rejected. And then finally did win a prize with Narrative Magazine and was published there. And I think that the message there was, you know, it finally won these prizes, but I could never decide whether it was the many years of rejection that were the measure of my worth as a writer or whether it was the prize. And I finally realized it doesn't matter because it's arbitrary. You know, the external measurement of your work is, in a way, arbitrary. You need it in order to have a career. If you want to get paid for your work, you need people to tell you that it's good and want to publish it. But even if they do, it doesn't mean that the rest of your writing career is going to be smooth sailing. So there has to be some other reason to keep writing, and that, I think, doesn't boil down to belief or faith in yourself. It boils down to an obsession. And the thing that I wanted to say to these girls at my all-girl Catholic high school on Sunday is to trust your obsessions. It wasn't until I was 33 that I finally, well, and that was long after I was 33, that I finally learned to trust my obsessions. It probably wasn't until the novel got sold that I finally sort of settled into this idea that I don't have to apologize for being a writer. And I was a mother too, and I can remember feeling guilty when I wasn't writing and guilty when I wasn't with my kids. So I was in a perpetual state of guilt probably for a whole decade there, and that was such wasted emotion. I should have just settled in and said, well, I'm going to do it anyway. I may as well not waste time feeling guilty. I remember one time, I just had my fourth child. She was probably 2 months old. And it was Saturday morning, and I was desperate to get in a couple hours. And I just remember leaving my husband standing in the doorway, and he's got, like, the infant with, you know, a hot bottle of breast milk, and then the three other kids, like, you know, four kids under seven, and I'm feeling guilty. And I back my car out of the driveway, and I back right into the neighbor's car. I'm like, oh, shit. So I leave a note, you know, I put it on the windshield, and I'm like, okay, bye. I'm going anyway. You know, that desperation to write, even if you can't justify it to yourself, you got to do it anyway. So the novel, around this time when I was publishing stories, I thought, oh, I'll write enough stories to publish a collection. I'll have a book in a year. It'll be awesome. I was in the MFA program at that time. So I set out to write this short story, coming of age short story set in London. And it got to be about 25 pages. This is probably 12 years ago now. And then it blew past short story length, and it got to be about 80 pages. And I thought, well, maybe it's a novella. It kind of has a kind of a sort of ending. But I wasn't happy with that. I knew that there was more of a story there than I had told yet. So I kept writing, and I wrote for another 4 years probably. And then I had a friend, another writer friend, who said, he was actually my workshop leader at the Tin House Workshop, Charles D'Ambrosio, and he said, well, let me send some of this to my agent. So he sent 30 pages of the novel along with some short stories to his agent, and she called me and she said, you know, love your writing, wonderful, I love your short story. She said, but let's talk about the novel. And I was like, this doesn't sound good. And she said, I would hate for you to write a quiet novel. And I still don't. I didn't end up writing a quiet novel, but if I had, I wouldn't regret it because I love quiet novels, and I have, you know, there's some of my most treasured reading experiences have been quiet novels. But she also said, you know, a novel can't just be characters moving through time, making bad decisions about their lives. Something has to be bearing down on them from the outside. And I thought about that a lot, and I think what she was telling me was that I had no plot. And she was right. But luckily, I didn't know that until I figured it out, what the plot was, because I would have been despairing to have spent 5 years writing a plotless novel. But one day I was writing in Starbucks, and the plot kind of arrived. I had been writing backstory about our main character in London and Paris, and then suddenly the narrative shifted to a much older main character living in San Francisco, happily married mother of three, whose 20-year-old son had been in a terrible car accident. And the narrative shifted from first person to second person. It's a direct address from Annie to her son, Robbie, who has been placed in a medically induced coma and can't hear her. And that's when the plot arrived, and that's when the writing of the book became a whole different kind of urgent task. And what I tell writers now when they ask about plot is I think there's just one question you can ask yourself, which is, what is the urgent reason for telling this story now? And until that day in Starbucks, I didn't have an answer to that question. And once the answer arrived, it was much clearer to me what the purpose of this book was going to be. So with that, maybe I will just read from the beginning, just to give you a sense of the voice. London, the year I turned 20. I wore a winter coat, the first I'd ever owned, a man's coat purchased at a secondhand store. I wore it every day, along with a silk scarf tied around my neck, imagining I looked arty or sophisticated. Each scarf cost a pound, and I bought them from an Indian woman who kept a stall in the tube station at Victoria, where I caught my train to work. They were thin, crinkled things, not the sort of scarves that ought to be worn to work in an office or that offered any protection against the cold. But I could not resist them, their weightlessness and soft, faint colors. The money I spent on them and the habit I adopted of wearing a different one each day seems to me now a haphazard indulgence, an attempt to prove that I was the kind of girl capable of throwing herself headlong into an affair with her boss, a married man twice her age, and escaping without consequence. I moved from a youth hostel in Earl's Court to a boarding house in Victoria. The building was 5 stories high, made of gray stone, on a block not far from the tube station. My room was 10 feet square with bright blue walls, a laminate desk, and a hard, narrow bed covered in a thin white spread. There were bathrooms down the hall. There were no showers, only a single tub and a hose you attached to the faucet for washing your hair. There was no lock on the room with the bathtub, so I made a habit of propping a chair in front of the door for privacy. The chair, as I recall, did not stop Patrick Argall. Nothing much stopped Patrick when he had an idea in his mind. He simply shoved the door hard, and I welcomed him, I suppose, as I always did, and he undressed and climbed in. This is the part I skip when my kids are in the room. It's not that racy, but... Our wet bodies were awkwardly entangled long enough to please him, then he left, as he always did, taking my heart with him. My rent was £60 a week, including breakfast and dinner. The meals were served buffet-style in the dining room downstairs. There were eggs and toast and stewed tomatoes for breakfast, meat pie or fish and chips or baked ham for dinner. It was a source of solidarity among the other boarders to complain about the food, but I could not, in good conscience, join in. I loved those meals, the bounty and efficiency of them, the thick gravies, the custards and puddings and soft, fat rolls. It seemed a small miracle to me to have so much available and to be paying for it all with my own wages. It pleased me, too, each time I handed over a pound coin in exchange for a scarf, and when I purchased at the second-hand shop in Notting Hill the winter coat, a full-length, single-breasted gray tweed with covered buttons and a wide collar that could be turned up against the cold. I wore my coat and scarf and descended the escalator into the bowels of Victoria Station, emerging again into the dense, unyielding energy of city life, feeling brisk and stylish and superior to the person I'd been when I'd left home. I was taken over by a sense of liberation and possibility. Any false steps I made now would be mine alone. Any foolish moves would be private business that had no bearing on the hopes and dreams of others and that would not later be a source of remorse or reckoning or pain. What a shock to discover some 20 years later that exactly the opposite was true, to learn in the aftermath that I hadn't known the half of it, to stand in my San Francisco kitchen last June and slip my finger through the flap of a white envelope and to find a black and white photograph of myself in that tweed coat, standing on the chalk down of the white cliffs of Dover, waiting to board a ferry to Paris. It was a photograph innocent enough to anyone unacquainted with its history, its treacherous biological imperatives, its call for reparations left unpaid. The scarf I was wearing had been hand-colored a blunt red. It was tied around my neck like a choker, like a noose, but it wasn't me who was about to hang. And then I'll just read a bit from... Chapter 1, that was the preface, and this is the morning that Jonathan and Annie find out their son has been in an accident. The novel moves back and forth in time. It's not always wise to assume that just because the surface of the world appears undisturbed, life is where you left it. Monday morning, September 5th, 2011, 20 minutes after 8, I was doing the breakfast dishes when the phone rang. I wiped one hand on a dishcloth and picked up on the second ring. I spoke a quiet hello. You were sleeping directly upstairs in your sister's room, and after the commotion of the night before, I didn't want the noise to wake you. There was static on the line. I was about to launch into my national do not call list speech when a stranger spoke your name. I said what I believed, that you were still asleep. You couldn't come to the phone. I heard voices in the background, then a contusion of words. Automobile accident. Broken rib cage, possible brain injury, blunt renal trauma. I began to shake. I called for your father. I thrust the phone at him as if it were burning my hand. I ran upstairs. Part of me was certain I would find you where I'd left you, on top of Polly's bed, her decorative pillow shaped like a ballet shoe, still cradling your head. I flung open the door to her room. I stepped toward the bed, but you weren't in it. Your truck was in the driveway, Robbie, but you were nowhere in the house. We learned later that you'd been riding in the passenger seat of an old Volvo sedan when it flipped just north of Santa Cruz and expelled you into a ravine. The driver's seatbelt had held, but yours had not. Jonathan and I battled our way through the San Francisco traffic and sped 30 miles south on the highway, out of the fog and into the sunlight. We reached the peninsula and took the off-ramp and argued over the route in voices clipped with panic. We made our way through that alien topography, the university with its low, wide sandstone buildings and flat expanses of sky and lawn, the shopping center with its vats of flowers and its acres of parking lot, the hospital inside its immaculate suburbia, that sunlit peninsula pressed between the green bay and a bank of hills the color of straw that 5 months later your father would begin to call home. We drove up the hospital's main drive and circled the extravagant brick fountain, an oasis of shaped trees growing in its center. I was the one who'd counted your drinks the night before. I was the one who'd somehow incited a riot, then in the aftermath, set about making sure my three children were safe for the night under the same roof. I was the one who'd moved a sleeping Polly in with Clara so you could have Polly's bed. If I had not made you stay, if I had not altered that sliver of fate, if I had not plucked that single wing from that single butterfly, you wouldn't have ended up in that car. You'd have said your goodbyes and driven across the Bay Bridge to Berkeley and fallen into bed and slept until noon. At the main entrance to the hospital were two dogs, eyes half closed, chins flat on the ground in a posture of patient defeat. That was the attitude to avoid. The task at hand, my task, was not to wait patiently, but to act, to undo the twist of fate, to be vigilant and merciless in advocating for your medical care, to accept nothing less than a full recovery, to ask every question, to overturn every stone. Did I suspect that first morning that there were some stones better left buried in the dust? That I might wish for the results of certain biological interrogations to be kept hidden, not only from you and from your father, but from myself? I don't think I did. Denial, as any addict in recovery will tell you, is not defined as knowing something and pretending you don't. It is failing to see it at all. I'll stop there.
I'd like to remind our audiences online and radio that they're listening to Jan Allison speaking about her novel, A Small Indiscretion. It's time for questions and answers. Does someone have a first question? One of the things that you said about pretending that you knew what you were doing or, you know, just trying to get by like that. I wrote for the internal newspaper of a big law firm in New York as a bunch of jokes. And one of my jokes was, pretending that you know what you're doing is the first thing you learn as a young associate and the last thing you forget as a senior partner.
That's good.
So it's not confined to what you did.
That's right.
It's extremely widespread.
Yeah.
So it's not easy to ask questions about your novel without asking about your private life. But when you wrote this, as you said, you know, you suddenly, did you really just suddenly realize that if your mother-in-law reads it, or did you know way in advance, or did you just kind of, it came to you as a surprise?
Well, it was my first short story that I kind of had that, oh my God, my mother-in-law is going to read this. By the time the novel came along, I had published several short stories, and so I knew how horrible it was going to be to have, you know, some members of the family read it. It was difficult. It was difficult for my parents to read it. It was difficult when my husband read it. I had worked very, very hard to make the husband character in the book super different from my husband, which is not easy when you've been married for 20 whatever years I've been married, because that husband kind of gets in your head. So I really worked hard, and I specifically made the husband in the book an optimist in his, you know, core nature. He's an optimist. And yet, my husband still thought it was him. And so he's not a pessimist, but he is He's a realist. And so that just goes to show you that you don't have control over what people see in your novel. But he was okay with it. He was fine with it.
You mentioned writing down a lot of those memories when you were living abroad. How did those memories and notes that you took evolve over 20 years when you started to write them down?
When I went back to look at the notes I had taken to see what could be salvaged, really, to see if there were, you know, if the brilliant passages that I had remembered writing were actually there, and I am sorry to report that they weren't. The writing in those notebooks is very clunky and ruminative and internalized, let's call it. And it's, you know, it's the writing of a 19 and 20-year-old. And as a reader, I'm not that interested in sensibilities that are much younger than, you know, my own now. And as a writer, I found out that I wasn't very interested in the sensibility of myself at that age. But I was able to get, you know, some of the... I was able to get some of that, the nuances of kind of how careless and reckless a person that age can be while thinking that everything is kind of under control, which is what I thought. I thought, oh, I've got this all under control. And I was not as wild as Annie is in the book, but it gave me a basis for thinking it is realistic, even though, at my age now, it's hard for me to imagine that my kids could be that reckless and stupid, and I'm sure that they would never. But it gave me some authenticity. But because I was writing from a much older point of view, the younger voice was not relevant in the end. But I think what it was relevant was learning the craft. So it was like scales. You know, it was like 10 years of doing my scales. I had established the habit of trying to translate experience or imagination into language.
I'm very curious about, you had these life experiences where you were wide open, and then you mentioned about the phone booth, how you couldn't get a hold of anybody, and now your kids could get a hold of you. And so I'm curious of what philosophy you tell your kids now, of days with this different, because you said, oh no, I always want to be able to get hold of my kids now. So I'm curious of how you...
What is so interesting to me is that they seem to want to be in touch with us, which is different. I don't know if it is particular to this generation or if it is the technology itself that is creating this very different dynamic. When I left for college, you know, you could only communicate with your mother if you called her on the phone in your room, and it cost money, and so we didn't. And she very much was ready to be done with parenting us. When my son went off to college in the fall, you know, we didn't, if I hadn't heard from him for maybe a week, I might send him a text, but it almost never happened that I hadn't heard from him in a week. I think that there's a fluidity of communication between our generation and our children's generation that's very different. And I almost think you have to intentionally decide to get off the grid to know what it feels like to be alone. And I do hope my kids will do that as much as I dread it. It also depends a little bit on the kid. I mean, we have four and they're at different levels of, you know, how you would feel if they went off. I mean, the things I did, like when I left Australia, I told my mother that I was with these two friends that I'd been living with in Australia, but I wasn't because they hadn't saved any money and they went home. And I took trains all over India by myself. I trekked in the Himalayas by myself. I hiked in the jungle. I took crazy buses in the middle of the night. I did a lot of stuff that I would be really worried if I knew my kids were doing. So hopefully they won't tell me till afterward.
You mentioned that it, your point of view, that it's hard for you to get back even into your notes from a 19-year-old. And you go back and forth in the novel. How was it hard to even those things out when you write about the older character, I mean, versus the younger character? Was it hard to even that out, or were you able to put yourself into a frame of mind?
I was writing about the younger Annie from the older Annie's point of view. So she was remembering, and the novel is an act of memory in a way. Although when you're in readers have said when they're in the moments, she goes off on this wild weekend in Paris with this very inappropriate foursome. It's very much the action moving forward in time then, but always is this older intelligence bearing down on that. So in terms of the voice, I feel like really you can't settle into the novel until you've got the voice right. And when 4 years in, that voice shifted into an older Annie's point of view and in this direct address to her son who was in a car accident, I did struggle with that for quite a while because the voice had shifted, but I didn't know how Annie had gotten from that weekend in Paris to 20 years later, she's married with 3 kids and runs a lighting store. And so I didn't have that. I didn't know who she was because I didn't know what had happened to her, but I couldn't find out what had happened to her because she was the voice who had to tell me the story. And so I was writing in circles for a while, but what I just learned, if you keep writing in circles, eventually you'll straighten out.
Next question.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you very much for the insight into an experience I could never imagine.
You're welcome.
I'm delighted. And tell me, why did you choose that for the title, A Small Indiscretion?
I didn't, actually. My editor did. The book had many different titles, and every time a new title would occur to me, I would name the file I was working on, that version, the new title. So I have a record of, I probably have 2 dozen titles. And I think when the book was sold, I think when I signed with my agent, it was called The Darkness Ahead, which is a reference to a art exhibit at the Tate that two of the characters in the book go to see. And then when we sold it to Random House, it was called Something Light, Something with Light in it, because she runs this lighting store and light is one of the motifs. And my editor called me up, very first time I ever talked to her after she bought the book. She bought the book, well, I didn't tell this part of the story, but I had set the book aside for 18 months because I accidentally started writing another book. I started writing a short story that turned into 600 pages of a second manuscript, which I'm back to writing now. And then I rediscovered this manuscript in March before we sold it. I'd never had a first draft. By June, I had a first draft. September, I got an agent. And January, it was sold overnight to Random House. And my agent is a very famous agent. And she was kind of intimidating, so I was very nervous the first time I talked to her. And the first thing she said was, now let's talk about the title. Well, she said, we're so excited, blah, blah, blah. Let's talk about the title. It was called The Diamond Lights. She said, The Diamond Lights, that's pretty. I think we can do better. And she said, how about A Small Indiscretion? And that's how it emerged. And there's a huge debate in the book clubs that I visited, what is The Small Indiscretion? But I'm not going to tell you that because I know you haven't read the book. So you can send me an email and let me know what you think it was, because actually there are quite a few large indiscretions. It's meant to be ironic.
Well, there's time for a couple more questions. Anybody else have a question? All right. When you said you kept notes all this time and you acted like a writer, you read, you et cetera, et cetera. When did you discover that you were a writer? When you have the 2 children? I mean, did you say, now I want to be a writer?
No, I didn't. I said, now I want to sign up for this writing class. So I wanted to sign up for a writing class. I wanted to take this writing class. And that's as far as I let myself get. And then I wanted to get into the MFA program and I wanted to finish a short story. So I really never... I didn't tell people I was a writer probably until that story was picked up by the O. Henry Prize collection. Because then I finally figured, well, even my husband has to admit that maybe this is a real thing now. So, I think in this business, and maybe in any business, it's a good idea not to get ahead of yourself. I wouldn't let myself imagining writing the acknowledgments in this novel until it was sold, because I said to myself, don't get ahead of you. Like, who am I going to thank? Oh, no. Don't do that. It might not get sold. It might not get finished. So it was a long time.
Any other questions? All right, great. Well, thank you very much, Jan.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.